me pones un ejemplo. Entonces, si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk, real people, real stories. The He's Jizz Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Jizz Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Femtech, or female technology, these are driven products and services that offer solutions designed to address women's unique health and wellness needs. Meet Dr. Marina Gerner, an award-winning financial journalist and columnist who has worked, and her work has appeared in The Economist, Wall Street Journal, The Times, Financial Times, The Guardian, and Wired. She's also an adjunct professor at NYU's Stern School of Business and holds a PhD from the London School of Economics. Today, we talk to Marina about her latest book, The Vagina Business, the innovative breakthroughs that could change everything in women's health. Her book sheds light on the ever-evolving femtech industry and the innovations that could transform the way we approach medicine, science, and business. With research backed by grants from the prestigious Alfred P. Sloan Foundation and the Society of Authors, Marina brings a fresh perspective to a conversation that's been overlooked for far too long. Marina, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for such a kind and powerful introduction.
The honor is ours. We've been talking on and off. Before we got on set, I was telling you how excited I am. Just walk us through. Tell us a little bit about your journey and your walk, and how did you get involved in this work?
Yes. So I'm a journalist. I've been a journalist for about 15 years. And what's unusual about me is that in that time, I've covered a whole range of subjects. So initially, I was a news reporter on a local paper, and I wrote stories like, you know, the birth of a baby giraffe at the zoo. And then I started writing reviews of books and of exhibitions. And then in about 2015, I reinvented myself as a financial journalist. I started writing about the stock market and about pensions, retirement, investments. And then I went freelance in 2018 and broadened out and wrote about health and technology. And so I cover all of these different areas, and I think that's important to note because if you go into a bookstore and you look for my book, The Vagina Business, it will be in different sections depending on the bookstore. So sometimes you will find it in the business section. Sometimes it's in social sciences. Other times it's in feminism. Sometimes it's in medicine, health, or wellness. And all of these categories are true. It's just that the bookshop decides, you know, where to put it. And I think the only way to really understand the issues we're facing in women's health is to look at them from multiple perspectives. Because if I was only looking at the business side of things, you know, I would say, wow, women's health is an incredible opportunity from a business point of view. Why is it underinvested? And I would miss the whole cultural side of things. If I only looked at the cultural side of things, I would miss the financial underpinning of everything. So I think what I do is I bring together these multidisciplinary perspectives to shed light on a topic that I think is hugely important.
Mm. Why do you think women's health has been historically overlooked in the business and medicine world?
Yeah, there are multiple reasons for that. One was that our medical understanding has been shaped around the male body. So let me give you an example for that. So if I'm asking you to imagine a person who's having a heart attack, you know, who do you see? I'll put that to the audience and to you.
Many times we think of the situation and we always call our primary care physician. That'll be my first thought of mine.
Yeah. So most people, just when you visualize the kind of person that is having a heart attack, most people say they see an old man. And the symptoms that they tend to envision are pressure on the chest and then pain radiating down the left-hand side. And it turns out that those symptoms are typical for men, but they're not actually typical for women. And as a result, women are 50% more likely to be misdiagnosed after having a heart attack. Women also wait longer to seek help, and the outcomes are worse for women. And so as a journalist, I was really excited when I came across a company called Bloomer Tech, led by Alicia Chong Rodriguez. And what they've created is the coolest thing. It's a smart bra that allows women who are at risk of cardiovascular disease to monitor their heart health. And so I really wanted to write the story of this smart bra and of the founder. But initially, when I pitched the story to my editors, there was a perception that the topic was a bit niche, even though, you know, it applies to over 50% of the population. Mm-hmm. And but the story stayed with me. So as a journalist, you know, there are some stories you write that are just part of the news flow, and then other stories that really grab you and stay on your mind. And so the smart bra, it stayed with me, and then COVID happened. And I think during COVID, a few things shifted. One was that the power dynamic between the clinician and the patient moved a bit from the doctor's practice to our homes, because we started testing ourselves for COVID and we trusted people to test themselves. And the other thing that happened was that early on, if you think back to the start of COVID, men had worse symptoms than women. So nowadays, women are more likely to have long-term COVID, and especially perimenopausal women. But at the time, men were more affected. And so I think if you were to be cynical, you could say we started to pay more attention to sex differences in health because men were more affected. And at the time, I finally managed to write the story about the smart bra, and it did really well. And that's one of the things that got me into it. And I think it's one of the prime examples of how we have overlooked female health by doing our research on men. And it was only 1993 that women and people of color were officially included in clinical trials. So to this day, we have lots of gaps in our understanding of our health that we're trying to fill. And unfortunately, we still haven't reached parity, including, well, if you want to take it further, including in animal studies. You know, we still focus on male mice, mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And I looked into this, and I have a quote in the book of some researchers explaining why they excluded female mice. And they say, oh, we didn't include female mice because their cages were harder to clean. Mm. So, you know, that's clearly an excuse. So that's mm-hmm. the kind of explanation you sometimes get from people. And then studies that do include women don't necessarily analyze their results by sex. So even if women have been included as participants, we don't necessarily know what that means or what that has resulted in.
For me, and we'll get into your book a little bit more, this is something immediately that grabbed me. You start leading us into this journey as a journalist that got you hooked into the story. But it was interesting for me when I started thinking about it. I'm like, wait, many times women have like these pains. I would think about my mom and sisters and stuff like that, that because of their bra and maybe the like the iron pieces and the way their bras were made before,
yeah,
them moving and twitching in different areas. Oh, like it's too tight. I feel uncomfortable.
Yes.
But you broke it down and you shared in data about the fatty tissues that women have versus males and so on and so forth. But it allowed me to think, what a great innovation, right? Because if you can save a life, think about how much a woman predetermines what she's going to do next. Well, I have my baby home. I'm not going to the doctor now. I can't move around. I have to call people. I don't have the supports in place. I wasn't planning to go to the doctor. So this was one of the things that for me early on, I was like, wow, this is going to be amazing. Because even though that it's overlooked, it's much, much, much needed. So thank you for shedding light on that. About your book, I mean, let's just get right into it. I'm excited about it. I've already put it up on our website. And one of the things that I kind of start out, let's just talk about the title, the vagina business, right?
Yes.
Because there's many taboos about that. Take us away. The vagina business, the innovative breakthroughs that could change everything in women's health.
Yes, it's important to say it with the subtitle, right? Because the subtitle does a lot of the explaining. And that's actually something just from a publishing perspective. You know, the difference between covers in fiction and nonfiction is that nonfiction books have a subtitle. That's something that's good to know. Yeah. So when I first thought of the book, it arrived with this title. And I can explain afterwards why it arrived with the title. But, you know, when my agent and I, when we went out to speak to different publishers to talk about the book, to sell the book, they all said, yeah, this is a brilliant idea, but are you sure about the title? You will have to change the title. And I said, no, I think this is the right title. I think the word vagina needs to be on the cover because my goal is to destigmatize the conversation and to normalize it. And so my book was sold. I had a book deal with the biggest women-owned publishing house in the world. And so I thought, okay, now everything is sorted. But then they had some feedback from booksellers who were saying, oh, you know, we may not promote the book, we may not display the book. And so they came back to me and they said, please, can you come up with 16 alternative titles?
Mm.
And I did. I called two of my best friends and we came up with lots of other titles. And then they tested all of those titles on our target audience. And guess which title won?
Mm.
The Vagina Business. Because it really resonates with readers. I think people are tired of euphemisms and they're tired of saying your V or your whatever, you know, term. So that was really important. But when the book came out, there were still other obstacles. I had a venue that turned me down from hosting my book launch purely based on the title and another author who didn't write me a blurb, also just based on the title. And then the book won two awards, which is amazing, and I'm very grateful for that. And one award was supposed to be announced in Dubai, but then the evening before, the organizer calls me and she says, I'm sorry, but we actually can't say the title on stage. The government might close down the whole conference. And so, you know, it was announced somewhere else. And so these things keep happening, but at the same time, I'm getting the most powerful messages from readers almost every day. And there are some common themes. And one of them is that women tell me they read the book in public on purpose so that others can see the cover and so that they can start conversations and so that they can, you know, make other people cringe and kind of see their reactions. And I think that's very powerful. And quite a few people have told me, you know, you've changed the way I talk to my daughter, or I finally had a conversation with my mother about something we've never spoken about. So I think it was definitely worth keeping the title because oftentimes it's also what attracts people, what intrigues people, you know, what catches their eye to begin with. And let me explain to you why I insisted on this title. So the smart bra was the first thing that got me into this space. And then the other thing was that I was in my early 30s and I knew that I wanted to have children soon. And I also knew that the majority of first-time mothers experience a birth injury. So the statistic is that 9 in 10 first-time mothers experience a birth injury. And whether that's vaginal tearing or a C-section, you know, that's an automatic kind of injury. So I wanted to look into preventative options because I think when we don't talk about things like birth injuries, we prevent people from even thinking that it's possible to prevent it or do something about it. You know, we just normalize it as something that, oh, well, welcome to being a woman, you know, birth is just going to be horrible. But I think we've had enough of that attitude. And I think it's time to come up with better solutions. So I found a startup in California that is creating a birth dilator. What it does is it pre-stretches the muscles of the vaginal canal in the first stage of labor. So while you're having contractions, and then by the time the baby comes through, the idea is that those muscles have been pre-stretched, so you're less likely to experience tearing. It's not on the market yet, but, you know, that's the idea behind it if it makes it through clinical trials. And I thought that's fantastic because it's such a simple device. It's a dilator. Dilators are already used in other areas of health, like vaginismus, for example. It's a preventative device, which is very rare. you know, unfortunately, our healthcare is not preventative still as a whole. And it's also quite simple. It's not a drug or anything, you know, it's a relatively simple device. And when I started the research in the field, doing the research in the field of birth, I learned that the last big innovation in the standard of care of birth was the epidural, which was popularized in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And that blew my mind, because that means if you're pregnant and you're going into the hospital right now to give birth, you'll be offered the epidural as, you know, one of the best possible options. And there's no other area of technology or society where we wheel something out from the 1950s and we say, hey, look at this incredible cutting edge floppy disk. You know, but in birth, that's exactly what we do. There's another instrument, the forceps, which is basically a set of salad forks, and that's from the 17th century. And so I wondered, you know, why haven't we seen much more innovation? Why haven't we seen hundreds of new options over the last 70 years, you know, for women who give birth? There has been innovation focused on the fetus, but what about the mother, right? So I spoke to founders who have vagina-centric inventions, whether that's birth injuries or menopause symptoms. And one thing I kept hearing from them again and again and again is that they struggle to raise money because investors, and in particular venture capital investors who fund innovative startups, are predominantly male, and they are too embarrassed by the topic. So I have a quote in the book of an investor who says, "I don't want to talk about vaginas in my Monday morning partner meeting." Mm-hmm. And, you know, that tells you kind of the attitude that exists in the investment world. And that made me very angry to think that we don't get the innovation that we clearly need and want and deserve is because there's a bunch of guys somewhere in a boardroom and they are too embarrassed to talk about vaginas in a business setting in front of other guys. You know, how is that possible? And I'm a journalist, so I wrote a story called "We Need to Talk About Investors' Problem with Vaginas." And that story went viral and it really hit a nerve and it got a huge response. And so I used it as a proof of concept to then write a whole book. And I've interviewed over 100 people across 15 countries who are, you know, changing the way we think about female bodies and about women's health.
Girl, speak your truth. Actually, when I had an opportunity to see, I was like, wait a minute, you better add advocate, community leader, and social justice gangster right here, because she's coming out with opportunities to really shed light on the importance of what FemTech is doing. First, I want to say that your efforts in trying to lead this opportunity, the title itself says, listen, thank you for the award. If I can't accept it with my title, fine, I won't go. But this is the movement. And now you have allyship and other women and other people that is willing to stand, because you're also standing up for the transgender. You're also standing up for the people who have been cut out of their voices. And this is a movement. And yes. I know that in some way, shape, or form, you're going to continue to push this forward and you're going to continue to grow with this, because it will start seeping. It'll start breaking in some way, shape, or form. And yes, right now, investors are cringing, but I got to see parts of your book where now you're just seeking some people who have money, who are women. Hey, let me tell you about this thing I got. So now at the end of the day, we will find people to match the movement with the need. And sooner rather than later, I know that the things will trickle, because as capitalism works, people love money and they'll forget of what they do. One of the things I saw was making it safe. And you talked about giving birth and making it safer. And this is the thing about FemTech. I also learned that there's so much about women make up about 80% of healthcare, but they're pushed out of the decision making. So how is it you're going to make tools that don't work for me, such as the breast pump? And then you're going to move in and say, well, we may need softer options to make it more attractive. We're willing to do that. And that creativity happens. They find engineers, hire two people from Dyson, hook that up and say, well, here's a new breast pump that we think is going to support all of the things. Because I think that you guys are trying to put the movement together to fit. You're not saying, listen, we are okay with these antiquated pieces. we do want to have safe, we want attractive kind of selling products that people will be okay with. And right now we've already learned breast pump and bras that can save lives. Tell us more. What kind of made it for you that you said to yourself, look, I've now realized that this book needs to exist. Title aside, now you know you're working with all of the tools, the anger that you already have within. What else drove you to say, I realize that I'm working on something and this is going to be true now?
Yeah, it started with anger and then it went to inspiration. And that's something I hear from readers all the time. You know, they say, oh, wow, I was so angry when I started the book. And by the end of it, I was fired up and I was energized and I was inspired and in awe of all these incredible entrepreneurs and all these people who are changing the future. And I think it's so important what you're saying about it being a movement, because I think it can only work as a movement. We can't just look at, you know, a set of products like breast pumps, but everybody has to come together. So that includes researchers and entrepreneurs and clinicians and investors in order to move women's health forward. And I love that you picked up on the Dyson example, because I thought that was hilarious. You know, she found these engineers who knew how to suck dust out of a carpet, and then they recreated that with breast milk. And I think the breast pump is a fantastic example, because it used to be such a big, cumbersome object. You couldn't use your hands, you couldn't move. And nowadays you just pop it into your bra and you don't have to hold it in your hands. You can do other things. And I'm currently on my US book tour. And so I've traveled to various places for, you know, just one day or a day and a half. And I have a baby, I am breastfeeding, so I'm using a breast pump all the time. And I'm so grateful for this device. You know, it allows me to do my US book tour. yeah, it is a phenomenal thing.
I mean, this is sensational. And there's so much that I was drawn to about this, because when you look at healthcare and you think about women, and you spoke about some of the ancient pieces that are still being used, it's really daunting to think that this is still happening. Why people aren't investing in such a thing where women are leaders. They're having our babies. They're leading hospitals. They are CEOs of things now. So women are multitasking all of the time. But I'm looking at it from a perspective, even from the example you shared earlier about male mice versus female mice, there's still so much taboo about this. There's a lot that's still unlooked at. When you think about women, unfortunately, in healthcare, you drew it out in this beautiful chart where you said, well, what people relate us with the most is our cycle. And then you kind of broke down different parts, apparel, and I think skin was at the very beginning of it. You guys have to put so much into being yourselves every day. Think about what that feels like to have a whole healthcare system not allowing you to have a voice, to have selection within this. So big up to you and to this movement, Marina. This is really something that's exciting. Tell me about what were some of the challenges of you putting this book together.
Yeah.
And all things being considered, it is a hefty book, which is like an encyclopedia. You really dug in. What were challenges for you?
Yeah. I like so many of the things you said. You know, there's one quote that a lot of people have picked up on, and I always love hearing what resonates with readers and what they quote back to me. And it relates directly to what you said about the system. And the quote is, society wants us to look good, but it doesn't care whether we feel well.
Mm.
I think, you know, you can look at the beauty industry as a direct point of contrast. And when we look at the biases that female entrepreneurs encounter, one of them is that women are more likely to raise money in an industry that's considered gender congruent, so like the beauty industry, and we're less likely to raise money in an industry like engineering or technology. So there is an interesting contrast there. Also, if you look at how much money goes into the beauty industry. And I have, you know, absolutely no beef with lipstick. I like lipstick, but that's a whole other conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I thought of when you were talking is, and I'm really grateful for this, I've heard from several universities that they've put the book onto the curriculum for both medical students more generally and for gynecology students.
Boom.
And I think that's really cool. And actually, just a few days ago, a review came out of the vagina business, and it's been reviewed in various newspapers. And this was the first review to be published in a medical journal called The Lancet. Mm. And so it was written by a gynecologist, and she, let me just, actually, I'll draw up the review because I really liked the way she started it. She's called Dr. Sajita Salvaraja. And she starts the review by describing a situation where she was performing a C-section. And she says, "Little Woods, please. Spencer Wells." You know, she's asking the scrub nurse to pass her all of these medical instruments. And then she points out that those surgical instruments that we use every day to operate on women are all named after men.
Mm.
And on the one hand, that's not surprising because they were, you know, named by men, after men. But on the other hand, that is still the case today. And do you know why the fallopian tubes are called fallopian tubes?
I would not.
Yeah, I only found out about this recently. So there was a guy called Gabriele Fallopio in the 16th century who was a Catholic priest. I'm not making this up. And this Catholic priest was an anatomist, and so he discovered the fallopian tubes. And so to this day, that's what we call them.
Oh, yeah. My God. I mean, this is a conversation that brings so much power. When we think about some of the stories that you have in here, but you break it down for us, the finance side of things, these economic forces that are shaping our system, how do you believe they will begin to change their minds and start to let go and loosen up and say, yes, it's for the greater good? How can they do that?
Yeah. So I sought out people who are leading that change. And that includes male investors, of course, because I think we need to have everyone on board, and we can't actually afford to wait for parity in the field of investment because it would take such a long time. I think, according to the World Economic Forum, it would take something like 250 years, you know, to reach gender equality in economics. So I think we need to have absolutely everybody on board. And I interview an investor called Antonio Miguel. He's based in Lisbon at a company called Mace, and he has invested in tampons, and so sustainable tampons. And I talked to him about how he got to make that decision and, you know, the thought process he went through. And then at the end, we put together a list of things that he has changed internally at his company. And I think that list is a really, you know, useful hands-on list of advice for what other investors and people in this space can do. And the first one, you would think that that's already done, but it's actually quite rare. So what they do is they track the interactions they have with female founders. You know, every investment fund has a list of companies they are reviewing the pipeline. And his company tracks whether the companies they have conversations with, whether they have a female founder. So that's actually a really simple thing to track. The other thing they do is they deliberately reach out to networks beyond their organic reach to broaden the top of the funnel. And then they also make pitching your company enjoyable to female founders. So they have researched what an ideal pitching scenario would look like for female entrepreneurs. And that, for example, includes having other women in the room.
Mm.
They also found that during the pandemic, women preferred pitching online, and that's something that women generally like to do because female founders feel under less pressure to think about what they're wearing, which I thought was fascinating. And I mentioned this to a male entrepreneur, and then he goes, "Oh, I never worry about what I'm wearing." And I was like, well, that's exactly the point. You don't have to, because you won't be judged in the same way as a female entrepreneur who knows that she will go into a room and people will look at what she's wearing and how she's talking, and they will make all of these judgments. They also are quite aware of the bias that people tend to have against women who are confident and assertive. You know, that's a quality that's seen as very important in a business leader. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, for women, we're more likely to then be seen as unlikable. And so they make sure to value confident women, because once you're aware of it, you know, you just can't. Yeah, exactly. You can't unsee it. And then you know it. They also never say, and this is a phrase I hear from entrepreneurs in this space all the time, that they will present their company and then the entrepreneur will say, oh, I've never heard of this before. Let me go home and ask my wife.
Wow.
And it's, on the one hand, it's understandable from a personal perspective, but on the other hand, there's no other space where you would do that. You wouldn't say, oh, you're asking me about a space investment. Let me go ask an astronaut. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. You wouldn't ever ask one person about a business case. You would actually look at the market. You would look at the unmet need, at the total addressable market, you know, at the opportunity. You wouldn't rely on one person. And also, all women are different, right? Their wife may not experience this particular thing, or she may not tell them about it, or she may not know. And so that's a hurdle that is quite particular to the femtech space, is that people want to make it, how do I say this? People have this personal hurdle that they need to overcome.
You know, there's so much that you said here. I like to lead. Only place I think that women are not judged by their clothes, if you come to my school, girls are wearing pajamas. Everyone wearing pajamas every day. It's easy to wear. I think the other piece for me is the piece of the biases. Early on in your intro, you know, skin in the game is an awkward transition that happens between a woman she's shopping for condoms. And she's like, I need to find what works and what not. And she runs into her boss in the same aisle.
Yeah.
For me, that just speaks to what you just said. If a male is shopping and he runs into his female boss, it's understandable. There's this double standard still around sexuality. And how do you think, drawing out this book, you also thought about these things? I know you shared this first story, and there was stories that you shared from the field here, but how is double standards still so prevalent in so many places?
Yeah. And going back to the shop situation, you know, something else I noticed at my local drugstore was they have a huge banner app saying, you know, Viagra offer 2-for-1, only $12.99 or something. Yes. And you would just never see that with any equivalent product. For women, and also the way that period products are displayed, the way that they're advertised or spoken about, and the way that they're censored online, on social media and in mainstream media. You know, a new report has just come out comparing how different products are censored online. And when it comes to ads for erectile dysfunction, for example, those bounce proudly through the algorithm on Meta, Amazon, Google, you know, on TV here in the US as well. But when it comes to lactation cookies or sex education around female bodies or anything around menopause, you know, those ads all get censored on Meta, on Amazon, and on Google. So entrepreneurs continue to encounter this particular obstacle and bias. And so how do you talk about something, or how do you advertise something that gets censored? And how do you, if you're forced to use euphemisms like this is for your V, you know, where people think V? I thought V was for vendetta. Exactly. You know, how do you overcome that if you're if the visuals that you're using are all like citrus fruit or all oranges and like lemons, you know, how do you deal with that? And I think many of these brands establish strong online communities, for example. But there are so many female health issues where women don't even know what they don't know and suffer in silence or on their own and don't realize that it's actually very common. So that is a really big double standard that remains.
Yeah, for me, I'm like, even listening to you, you talked about the male products, they are looked at as game changers, and the women products still seem like depressive. Growing up, my mom or my sisters or my wife, anyone sends me out to the store, go pick me, you know, my monthly, I need my tampons, whatever. And men are like uncomfortable purchasing it. And it's so interesting how some of these things happen. We begin to evolve as time has gone by, but have we made that shift? Because when young ladies are entering their cycles, there's still such a stigma behind this. Yeah. Young ladies go through a whole phase that happens as a mental change. There's so much conversation that needs to happen. And it's quite different than a dad talking to his male son about the bird and the bees. This is totally about your health and your wellness. And the conversation is still sort of depressive versus being helpful. And interesting enough, when you enter a place you visit as a tourist, you don't know the language, you're looking for products, you really can't explain what the product you really want. How do you explain to your pharmacist without getting blown up and they're calling it out on loudspeaker and all these things? It's really difficult and uncomfortable to really make this change, but something needs to happen for the betterment of the world and for betterment of just healthcare, period. What are some of the things that our listeners can get from your book? Like, if you open my book, this is something I want you guys to remember, that this is key important.
Yeah. I think when I started this research, I expected to learn more about technology and about innovation, but I also learned much more about my own body. And it's one of those things where you think you know, but there's actually much more to learn. And so one example, you mentioned periods. And right now we throw away menstrual blood, right? But it's actually a fascinating thing to look at and to research. And there are several researchers and companies who analyze now what menstrual blood is made of, and it has lots of biomarkers. And so, for example, for your cervical screening, the standard of care right now is you go into a doctor's office and they insert a speculum and they scrape some cells off your uterus, and it's really unpleasant. And then they send it off to a lab and they say whether HPV has been detected or not. And with menstrual blood, somebody could simply collect menstrual blood in a pad and send it off to a laboratory where they would analyze it for HPV and tell you, you know, whether it's present or not. And and that will be, once that is available everywhere, right now, I think it's just available in Canada, but once that's everywhere, that will be huge for cervical cancer screening. Right now, a lot of women don't attend their appointments, something like 30% in the UK don't attend. And I see these surveys saying, you know, why do looking into the emotional or other obstacles for why women don't attend screenings? But actually, you need to look at the screening itself. It's, you know, don't look at the women, look at the screening. It's an unpleasant situation. It's an unpleasant experience. So if we find ways of making it pleasant simply by, you know, asking someone to collect some menstrual blood in their own home and send it off, that's a whole other experience. And I think if we center the patient, if we center the woman, that changes a lot of how we think about those things. And menstrual blood can eventually, potentially, also be used to diagnose endometriosis and other things. Yeah, it's a very valuable resource, but as you say, there's still a lot of stigma around it.
But I think that you're onto some. What I started thinking about was these samples can be used to detect something that may be in your blood, diabetes, something you probably didn't know you were a carrier of, traits of. So this can be a screening that could support various things. Back where I'm from, it comes from, if you don't know, now you know. This is important because I feel that you are schooling us on a topic that is often hushed, and you are here to make this change. I want to talk more about this mental health piece. When you are thinking about femtech, are there opportunities that companies are specifically looking to support people who are dealing with mental health, severe mental health, or specific types of mental health diagnoses when they're creating these tools?
I have seen some more companies focus on PMDD and on diagnosing postpartum depression. So that is a growing area. I haven't covered it in the book because, you know, I had to choose to focus on a few different areas. But it's something I might cover in my newsletter eventually. I write a free newsletter on Substack about women's health and innovation where I continue the conversation. So if people are interested, you know, go and look it up.
Well, tell us a little bit how our listeners can find you, how to connect with you. I know you travel a lot, but after listening to this show, I'm sure people will want to find you. Tell us how we can find you.
Yeah, please do. So Substack is where I have my newsletter. And you can also find me on Instagram and LinkedIn and TikTok, all of those places.
So Marina, can you tell us a little bit how AI has changed or helped femtech, and tell us about anything you're hearing about this, where this is going?
Yeah. So AI is helpful when you have a large data set of some kind, right? And one interesting example I've seen is in the space of IVF, where AI can assist embryologists in the selection of embryos to be implanted. Because the way that those are assessed is through genetic testing and also visually. And so AI can take a large data set of embryos and then compare them across patients who've had different outcomes and look at your personal health history. And so it can assist embryologists in that selection. And that's already being used in that way. But I think one thing to remember and to be mindful of is that AI is trained on existing data sets, right? And at the very start of our conversation, we spoke about the gaps that exist and how the data is skewed. So we have to be very careful to not replicate and amplify our biases that already exist in the system by, you know, supercharging those things with AI.
Well, if nothing else, we've given you several new book ideas. So you'll be writing so many books now. You can thank me later. But at the end of the day, you have real life stories here. You've been in the field for so long. Is there a story that really has moved you to say, I am glad I'm on this journey. I am glad that I decided to step forward to fight for this. Is there a story that reminds you every day as to why this needs to happen? And tell us.
Yeah. I think what reminds me more than anything are the messages I get from readers, because that's a new story every day, you know, and it's a different person every day saying things like, my father gave me a copy of your book because I work in women's health, and now it's one of my most prized possessions. You know, I heard from a book club in Denver. They're reading the book in a few weeks' time, and they've asked their local bakery to make some custom-made biscuits for the book club. So there are all these stories that I just didn't see coming, you know, and that I couldn't have imagined. But it's incredible to hear how much the book resonates and that it sparks so many conversations in couples. And women tell me all the time, you know, I finished the book, I loved it, and now I'm giving it to my husband or my boyfriend.
Yeah.
And so I want to continue those conversations with him. I think he needs to be more aware of those things. Or, you know, a lot of mothers tell me, I had this book on the kitchen table, and my son saw it and he said, "Hey, you know, what's this?" And so it sparks all these different reactions and all these different conversations. And that is just amazing to me. It's also available at a lot of libraries. And so people tag me on Instagram when they've picked it up at a library. And sometimes it's on a shelf that says something like book of the day, you know, or inspiration of the day. And it's just amazing for me as an author to think that the book is out there and she's doing her own thing and she's reaching all of these people and people are finding her.
Girl, you need to be happy. I'm so glad that you are receiving this and hearing this in real time, that you're able to say, you know, if nothing else, if I don't become the bestseller, if I don't do this, at least I know that I have a following of people who are using it and putting it to good use. Tell me about males and what do you think you would like them to get from your book? Because a lot of the information that's here is just not playing around women. This is about finance. This is about outcomes and health and how research can help and shape different things. What do you want our male listeners to kind of get from this and say, hey, guys, pay some attention to this?
Yeah, I think it will depend on each person, you know, because I cover so many different life stages. So each reader gravitates towards another section. And I think each chapter speaks to certain groups of people. So it really depends. But I was on a PBS show last week, and the guy who was interviewing me, he said, "What do you want everybody to know about female anatomy?" And I said, "I would love for every person, men and women, to be able to draw a clitoris. Because right now, when you go to any public bathroom, you know, we see doodles of dicks everywhere, but nobody can draw a clitoris. And I think that's a very simple thing we could change."
Yes.
And that would be a big educational piece. And the guy said, "Oh, but isn't it quite complicated? You know, isn't it mysterious?" And I said, "No, there's a drawing in the book. It's not that complicated.
Open up and see." Let me ask you, thinking about school and curriculum, I know that this is made for older ages to kind of get into the deeper end. Is there a way that you've thought about younger generations or younger ages to being introduced, and in which way?
Yeah. Yeah. And I've spoken to educators. I'm approached by teachers a lot, actually, and including educational podcasts and so on. So I'm definitely thinking about earlier ages a lot, because there's such a big impact you can have when you provide people with education about their own bodies in a positive and empowering way, right? Because that stigma and that shame may not be there yet. And so if you celebrate getting your first period and, you know, you turn it into a big party, or if you talk about the menstrual cycle and you say, "Look, isn't this magical? Like, your cervical mucus, it changes throughout the cycle," mm-hmm. because around ovulation, it becomes more watery so that sperm can swim through. And outside of ovulation, you know, it's sticky and it blocks sperm. Isn't that clever? Or your fallopian tubes, which, you know, we will be naming Melinda Gates tubes right now. Your Melinda Gates tubes, they are not actually stationary. They can move. A lot of people don't realize this, but if one tube is damaged, for example, the other one can cross over to the ovary that's on the opposite side, and it can pick up an egg from there. Mm. Isn't that blowing?
You know that cancer is one of the leading, and still is, one of the biggest concerns in our nation for different things, and cervical cancer being up there as difficult. You talked earlier about having to have these monthly checkups, which are just stressful altogether, whether you do a mammogram or you have your or you have your OBGYN checkup or whatever it is that you do, they're just mind-blowing. What do you think that your book can offer people who are concerned about what they can put into practice facing that visit that can support how they approach it moving forward?
Yeah, So the cervical screening is not monthly. It depends. It's usually every couple of years, depending on your age and depending on whether HPV has been detected. And that can be part of the problem, actually, that it's something people only check every couple of years, right? And depending on the country that you're in, I think here in the US, it's from the age of 40, whereas in the UK, it's only from the age of 50. Mm-hmm. But something practical, I would say to people, is that if you feel there is an issue, trust your gut, because unfortunately, many of these things are still overlooked and normalized, and medical gaslighting can happen. Mm-hmm. So if you feel like there's an issue, you know, trust yourself, ask for a second opinion, ask more questions. If you're being prescribed something, ask the doctor, has this drug been tested on people like me? Mm. You know, talk to your family, your friends, your community, learn from each other, and seek out information and research.
You know, in education, we always say there's never a silly question. Ask more.
That's right. Why should there be a silly question if it's about something as important as your health?
Yeah. Well, one more thing. You actually dedicated this book to number one, to mom.
Yes.
What do you want? Now the book is out here. It's a smash. It's ready. I've uploaded it to my website and talked about these different places where people are sharing out. What do you want to say to mom now that it's here?
So the dedication I wrote is to my mother, obviously, and she loves it. She's very pleased. She actually first saw that at my book launch. She opened the book and she saw this page, and then she hugged the book, and it was very sweet. And yeah, my mom's the best and the coolest. So thank you. Thank you for everything.
Awesome. Well, before we let you go, the floor is yours. Anything you want to close out with our listeners? It's been a treat having you here. Tell us about what's next for you on the horizon, about your book, and what you want people to remember about you and the vagina business.
Yeah. One thing people say to me when they're reading the book is they say, you know, I normally never take notes inside of a book. I never highlight anything inside of a hardback book. But with your book, I did, because I wanted to go back to these pieces and I wanted to remember them. And so I want to say to your audience, I give you permission to do that. Mm. You can highlight as much as you want. You can take whatever notes you want, you know, so that you can share the book with others and talk about it in your book club and so on. And I love seeing it when people have lots of different post-its and lots of different color-coded things in the book. So please feel free to do that.
Well, thank you for blessing us this evening with such a great show, but also allowing us the permission to just mark that book up, tell us what we really think about, and put post-its on it. You know, when we recognize and embrace the power of the woman, we embark on a journey that's filled with courage, some setbacks, but lots of triumphs. This path, which is marked by sometimes pain, filled with accomplishments, family, and breakthroughs, shapes our world. Without women, what would we be? A world without foundation, filled with questions, yet little explanations. Simply put, greatness would not exist. This is the power of the woman, the greatest gift of all. Because on this platform it was built. Because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. Marina, thank you so much for such an amazing show. Blessings.
Thank you so much for having me and for your wonderful and thoughtful questions and comments.
Till we meet again, friends.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker.
in memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa. This is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde De La Rosa. Esto va dedicado a ti, mamá. Te extraño mucho.